Good evening, everybody. Franz Weinschenk here to welcome you to another edition of Valley Writers Read. And tonight we're pleased to feature a story by Margaret Garrett Irwin. Although she was born in Great Britain, she's lived in California since the early 60s and currently resides in Oakhurst. Tonight, Margaret remembers her early childhood when she lived in London during World War II. She calls her memoir Margaret's War, lots of moving and air raids. Here she is, Margaret Garrett Irwin, recalling Margaret's War, lots of moving and air raids.
Prologue. The Pan American jet was 3 hours out of San Francisco, bound for London Heathrow. I was very pleased because there were so few traveling on Sunday evening, September the 27th, 1987. Dinner had been served, and it was completely dark outside. This was my second transatlantic trip that year. My father, John Garrett, had passed away a week ago, and I was going to his funeral. It was my birthday. I was 50 years old. The attendants were going round the plane offering pillows and blankets and dimming the lights. I was able to put down the armrests and stretched out on 3 seats and be covered with blankets. Wonderful! I thought back over my early life with John and Marion Garrett. I became really sleepy, lulled by the constant throb of the engines. I slept. The eerie sound of the air raid warning with its mournful downtones woke me up out of a lovely dream. Mummy was calling me. Come along, darling. We must go downstairs to the Wilkes. Put on your dressing gown and slippers. Hurry up. Mr. and Mrs. Wilkes lived in the downstairs flat. All I wanted to do was to go back to sleep. We had only been living in this flat for 2 months, and we were always getting woken up for air raids. I dutifully followed my mother downstairs. Our neighbors had a Morrison shelter, which filled their living room. And sometimes, if there wasn't room under the big steel table, which was the Morrison, we went under the stairs, which we could do in the downstairs flat. Mummy rang the bell several times, but no one came to the door. They were not at home. Daddy wasn't there either. His work as a mechanical engineer kept him at London hospitals at night quite frequently. Suddenly, there was the noise of an engine directly overhead. We stepped out from the porch and could see the outline of an enemy plane. It was a clear, starlit night. Mummy drew me back under the porch, and we went and sat on the stairs in our own flat. We heard the unmistakable sound of the engine being cut back, preparatory to dropping a bomb. Mummy drew me close to her and prayed. Much later, we went back to bed after the all-clear siren. In the morning, Mummy woke me quite late, as it was a Saturday, and told me she heard on the radio that the bomb had veered off and landed in a field 10 miles away. It was a clear, frosty day in January. I was 5 years old. I was born 2 years before this awful war broke out, so I don't remember not being at war. I had never eaten a banana. My older cousins asked me what a banana looked like. I told them it looked like a new moon. I had seen pictures of bananas in the greengrocer's store. My earliest memory is probably just before the declaration of war on September the 2nd, 1939. Mummy was putting on makeup in the bathroom. I climbed on the cork-top stool so I could look over her shoulder at what she was doing. All of a sudden, everything happened very quickly. I overbalanced and hit my left eye on the basin and bit my tongue in half. I vaguely remember being rushed to the doctor by my mother, running with the stroller with me inside. My tongue was stitched back in place, and I had to wear horrible, ugly, horn-rimmed glasses, because when I hit my eye on the basin, the pupil turned in, and without the corrective specs, I looked cross-eyed. People were always talking about pre-war and before the war. I knew we had moved around a lot. Mostly it was just Mummy and me. My parents had put our furniture into storage when war broke out. We stayed with Mother's cousin Maury, George her husband, and Peggy and Jean their daughters, a lot older than me. They lived in Potter's Bar, 20 miles north of London, on higher ground. We all went outside at night and looked south to the distant inferno, which was the London Blitz in 1940. The sky was awesome with the fire colours, red, orange and yellow, which really stood out against the black of night. We all had gas masks. Mine was like Mickey Mouse with a red rubber tongue. For a little while, Mummy and I stayed in Kingham, a lovely village in the Cotswolds. We lived with Daddy's Aunt Emma. She was an old maid and very cantankerous. It was too quiet for Mummy, the Londoner. She missed the shops and cafes. We moved to Aylesbury, about 40 miles from London, and lived in digs. That is, we had rooms with a spinster, Miss Webb. I liked being there. I went to nursery school in Aston Clinton, and Mummy played the piano for dancing and singing. I had a friend named Brian Bickle, who had flaming red hair. One day we were chased by a huge Dalmatian dog. A few days before our family moved again, Brian and I watched as lorry after lorry went down the main road towards London. Every lorry was loaded with soldiers, probably Yanks, as when they saw us by the roadside, they threw us chewing gum. Daddy came down to visit now and again. One of these times, Mummy and Daddy were having tea in the kitchen with Miss Webb and calling me to hurry up. I had been washing my hands in the bathroom. I was eating a paste sandwich when a drop of water hit me on the nose. All eyes went to the ceiling. My father jumped up and ran upstairs. Oh, gosh, I had left the tap running. He wasn't too angry with me. However, a few days later, we were moving out. The official reason was because Miss Webb's friend, Miss Beardshaw, was retiring from her job and coming to live with her. We went to Winchester to stay with one of Daddy's brothers and his family. Uncle Charles, Auntie Renee, and Cynthia and John lived in a council house on the Stanmore Estate. Cynthia was 17 and John was 14. I started going to Stanmore School, the local council school. I had my fifth birthday while in Winchester and graduated from a green ration book to a blue one. Mummy and Daddy and all the other grown-ups had fawn ones. Fortunately, rationing did not last long enough for me to get one of them. Clothing coupons were in very short supply, so there was much make do and mend. My mother made me a green tweed coat and beret from a coat of hers. I was very proud to wear my new outfit to school. I was very scared of the boys. A few weeks after I started at Stanmore School, one of the older boys snatched the berry off of my head at playtime and threw it in the boys' lavatories and called me Four Eyes. We only stayed about 3 months in Winchester. The war was going quite well for the Allies, and the bombing had lessened. My father found an upstairs flat in a converted Edwardian house in Mill Hill, an outer London suburb, a pleasant, leafy area, about 12 miles northwest from Piccadilly Circus. We moved in December 1942. We travelled by steam train from Winchester to Waterloo in central London, a distance of about 65 miles. The train was very crowded with lots of soldiers, sailors and airmen, who were all very kind to me. Many of them were singing, "There'll always be an England while there's a country lane," and so on, and many others. I remember, "Land of hope and glory, mother of the free." After that, it meant much more to recite my prayer, "God bless all the soldiers, sailors and airmen." When we arrived at Waterloo Station, which became one of my favourite mainline stations, we headed for the escalators. This was my first experience of moving staircases, but they were to become a normal way of life for me. We had to take the Tube, which was an electric train that travelled underground through tunnels. We travelled down on two escalators to get to the platform. There were bunks along the platforms of the inner London tube stations. People were already settling down for the night in the comparative safety of the underground, while bombs were being dropped up at street level. Our station was at the end of the line. The last three stations were out in the open. It was already dark, and the lights were dimmed in case there was an air raid. There was a horrible smell at Mill Hill East Station. Daddy said it was from the gasometer, which was huge and towered over the whole area. We had to catch a double-decker bus, the 240, which ran from Golders Green to Mill Hill Broadway. We got off at the bottom of Hammers Hill, and a very short walk brought us to Carlmore House, which was divided into two flats. We were upstairs on the first floor. The room my parents called the lounge had a big Victorian-style bay window. My mother's grand piano had pride of place just inside the bay. There was a three-piece suite of a settee and two armchairs, a coffee table, two bookcases already stacked with books, and a standard lamp besides the overhead light. There was also a black telephone on a side table, and of course a wireless. There were similar houses on one side of the road and on the other a tree-lined playing field of one of England's public schools. During the war it was a convalescent military hospital, and we would see the patients dressed in bright blue suits strolling through the field. Daddy's work as a mechanical engineer responsible for the heating and cooling in London hospitals kept him away from home. He was based for the duration of the war at Dick Whittington Hospital in Archway, one of the first stations underground when going into London. It was about 5 miles from central London, and the reason for the hospital's name was because Dick Whittington had stopped there to rest on his way to London, and he almost turned around and went back home to Nottingham. But a voice is supposed to have urged him to turn again, Whittington, and go on to London. He did, and years later he became Sir Richard Whittington, Lord Mayor of London. Sometimes on a Sunday afternoon, Mummy and I went to visit Daddy. Mr. and Mrs. Holt would serve us tea. Mr. Holt was the resident engineer at the hospital. Their home had been bombed and they lived in a prefab on the hospital grounds. Walking from the station, we saw much bomb damage, gaping holes where buildings had stood the week before. Walls were torn off houses, leaving rooms exposed, furniture still there. This Highgate Archway area was not far from Muswell Hill, where I was born in Alexandra Palace Road. Alexandra Palace was where television had started, but had been closed down with the advent of the war. Highgate Cemetery was very near. Karl Marx, the founder of communism, is buried there. My parents had enrolled me in a Roman Catholic girls' school called St. Mary's Abbey and run by Franciscan nuns. I liked it much better than the school in Winchester. I wore the required uniform of powder blue long-sleeve blouse, blue and black striped tie and navy blue tunic. I was in the Montessori class. I was known as a non-Catholic, and I eventually became friends with four other non-Catholic girls. We kept our friendships going for many years, even after we went to different high schools. I had Catholic friends, too, but this was my first experience of being different. By no means was it to be my last. In order to reach the school, I walked up Hammers Hill to Mill Hill Village, where there is a tree on a small green dividing the road called the Ridgeway. There is a modern pub called the Three Hammers at the top of the hill, on the right side, and on the left a very ancient wooden structure which was the village butcher's store. I walked past the butcher's and a grocer's store and turned left, past a park which went down steeply, and there were wonderful views all the way to Hendon Aerodrome and beyond. The abbey was situated at a bend in the road and was built of red brick, just like our home. I entered through a door set right in the wall. During the summer of 1943, I had my tonsils removed at the Whittington Hospital. Among my memories are the kind Irish nurses. One of them said, "With those rosy cheeks, you could be a little Irish girl." I couldn't have any solid food, but they brought me ice cream, and I was promptly sick all over it. Back at school in late September, I was still in the Montessori class, but learning more now, how to write and to add and subtract using an abacus. Then came a night in early December with no air raid warning. "Wake up, wake up! Hurry up, dear!" Mummy was shaking me and urging me to get up and handing me my dressing gown, overcoat, gloves and woolly hat. It was the middle of the night and I could smell burning very close by. "We must get downstairs and outside immediately. We have been hit by a bomb," Mummy said. I looked towards the kitchen as we crossed the landing. A horrific sight met my eyes. Flames were leaping to the ceiling. Red, orange, yellow, and purple. There were constant sounds as bottles and cans exploded. An incendiary bomb had made a direct hit on the roof of our kitchen. As we came outside the front door, firemen rushed past us to tackle the fire. Something else was wrong. I knew Daddy had been home the night before. "Where is Daddy?" I asked. "He has gone around back and up the spiral staircase to try and save our food," Mummy replied. After what seemed a long while, Daddy was there with us. His hands were both bandaged. He had been unsuccessful in his efforts and burnt his hands in the attempt. The firemen had to make him give up. The Red Cross had performed first aid on his hands. Pretty soon it began to get light. It was December 1943, and there was some snow on the ground. We went inside and upstairs to our flat. The devastation of the kitchen was terrible. The whole room was completely black. Everything was burned. The floor was a mass of broken burnt wood, glass and china, all mixed up with our precious food, canned and bottled. Fruit and vegetables were all blackened and soaking. The smell was putrid. I will never forget that smell or that terrible night. Thank goodness the fire didn't spread to the rest of the flat, said Daddy. The three steps down from the hall probably saved us. As it is, we will have to live somewhere else until the kitchen is repaired. I am sure Mari will be able to squeeze us in, exclaimed Mummy. This dreadful war, how much more will we have to suffer? We are more fortunate than many, replied Daddy. Nobody got hurt or killed last night, he said rather ruefully, looking at his bandaged hands. We had already been going to go for Christmas to Potter's Bar. We stayed about 4 weeks while the kitchen was made livable again. Soon after our return home, we started attending the Church of England Church, St. Paul's, which was on the Ridgeway, the opposite way from where I went to school. We went past the Three Hammers and by the village pond, past the church hall and a group of four cottages, and then came the church, which was not very old church by English standards. It was built in the early 19th century by William Wilberforce, a statesman who was also responsible for abolishing slavery in England. It was almost opposite the main entrance to Mill Hill School, turned into a hospital during the war. The Reverend Harold Wood was the vicar at that church for many years. We always sat in the third pew on the right side of the church, which had a central aisle. After I learned to read, I entertained myself during the sermons by looking at a table of kindred and affinity at the back of the Book of Common Prayer. All the people you could not marry. I was invited to a birthday party just down the street. It was over at 6 o'clock. Mummy came to pick me up as it was already dark. You could kind of see your way from the white paint around the trunks of trees. This was done to stop you from walking into trees if you had to be out in the dark. We were almost home when something gave me a tremendous pain in my left leg, just by my knee. I screamed! Mummy put on her flashlight. A man was walking his spaniel dog. My leg had met up with the dog's mouth, who, not unnaturally, bit me. The man was very apologetic, but my mother really got angry with him. Instead of going straight home, we went on to the doctor's on the corner of Milton Road. I think the iodine was more painful than the bite. I still have the scar. The dreary winter months went past. There were frequent air raids. Listening to the wireless was an important event, especially the evening news, to hear how the war was progressing. Before the news, the chimes of Big Ben boomed out the time of day. This was the world-famous clock by the River Thames, next to the Houses of Parliament in Westminster, London. The radio also provided entertainment, in particular Tommy Handley's Itmar. It's that man again, it's that man again, it's that Tommy Handley in Itmar. The comedy program probably did more for morale than government propaganda. There was much excitement about D-Day, June the 6th, when the Allies crossed over into France. About that time, the Germans started sending flying bombs at all hours of the day or night. The pilotless aeroplanes were very frightening. The characteristic drone could be heard from a long way off, and then silence before the fall of the bomb. When there was an air raid warning while I was at school, the nuns herded us into the cloisters and prayed. The air raid warning had a very mournful, eerie sharpness, and the all-clear siren sounded a much more cheerful note. During the summer holidays, we went away to the depths of the Berkshire countryside and stayed in a lovely village called Berkshire. My father's family, the Garretts, came from this village. We stayed in a cottage for 3 weeks. It was very primitive. Water had to be got from the well in the front garden, and there was an outside privy down the back garden path. The privy door had a new moon carved in it to give light inside. There were sheets of newspaper to wipe your bottom, and a big bush of honeysuckle outside the door. It was in full bloom, and the smell was beautiful. The smell of the honeysuckle offset the smell from the privy, which was pretty pungent. The weather was glorious, and it was wonderfully peaceful. No air raid sirens, not many planes flying overhead. The only real excitement was when my grandparents, Richard and Sarah Garrett, and my godmother, Miss Margaret Garrett, Daddy's younger sister, came to visit one afternoon, travelling from Eastleigh by local train. I was named after Auntie Margaret. We had a picnic in the grounds of Highclere Castle, and Daddy made a fire so we could have tea. We had an old iron kettle filled with water and put the kettle on the fire to heat the water. Unfortunately, he had made the fire too close to the tree we were sitting under, and the tree caught fire. Fortunately, it was soon put out, and we went back to the cottage garden for our tea. School started again on September the 27th. I was now in the first form. When I was asked how old I was, I proudly stated, 7 years old today. Mummy had tried teaching me to play the piano without much success, so it was arranged that I would start lessons with Miss Dawson, who was Mother Abbess's, the head nun's sister. She lived in a small house on the convent grounds. I had to go through the nuns' living quarters to reach the home. I started off with silly little pieces about butterflies and flowers. I wanted to play Beethoven and Chopin, like Mummy, right away. I also liked the popular song, Mersey dotes and dozy dotes and little lambs eat ivy, and kittle eat ivy too, wouldn't you? I did learn the scales and arpeggios. I hated practicing.
Oh, Mersey dotes and dozy dotes and little lambs eat ivy, a kittle eat ivy too, wouldn't you? A kiddly divey too, wouldn't you? A kiddly divey too, wouldn't you?
The war in Germany was over on May 8, 1945. I remember my parents taking me to the area in front of Buckingham Palace to see the royal family come out on the balcony. The crowds cheered and everyone was very happy. There were street parties in all the side streets of our neighbourhood. Hammers Lane was on a bus route, which turned down Dawes Lane to Mill Hill Broadway, so no party there. We were on the corner of Tennyson Road. It was a poet's area because there was Milton Road, Shakespeare Road and Byron Road. Tennyson Road had a party with long tables out in the street. And just as it got dark, they lit a huge bonfire that had been built with Hitler in effigy on the top. Seeing everything lit up was wonderful after all the years of blackout. We went to visit Granny and Grandad Garrett and Auntie Margaret at their home. One day we all went to Bournemouth, which was by the sea. We went through the New Forest, which was very pretty. To get to the sea from Bournemouth Station, we walked through some lovely gardens. The River Itchen, which was very shallow, ran through these gardens. I waded in the water. It was a lovely warm day. I had a pink knitted swimsuit donated to me by Mrs. Wilkes in the downstairs flat. Her daughter Valerie had grown out of it. The end of the beach closest to the front was all barbed wire, which had been put there against an invasion. I couldn't wait to get to the sea. It was so much fun, jumping up and down in the waves. Suddenly I found I was swimming, doing the dog paddle, which Mummy showed me. I was nearly 8 years old. The only bad thing about that day was when I put my clothes back on. A wasp was inside my dress and stung me. There was a first aid station close by, which had been set up in case people cut themselves on the barbed wire. The nurses took care of the wasping and all was fine. We didn't move again until March 1954, when my parents bought a house in another part of Mill Hill. The end.
Land of hope and glory, mother of the free, how shall we extol thee, who are born of thee?
Friends, that was Margaret Garrett Irwin recalling her recollections of World War II when she was indeed only a very little girl. Let me remind you that while many just think of World War II as an event that you read about once in a while in a history book, at the time it was absolutely the largest, most intense worldwide life and death struggle in human history. It involved all the major powers, was fought on just about all continents, lasted from 1938 to 1945, and mobilized some 100 million military troops. Before it ended, it would kill 60 million human beings. In her story tonight, Margaret and her family, who, although they moved a lot, did spend most of those war years in and around London. You know, after the Battle of Dunkirk, most everybody expected Britain to be invaded and to fall to the Germans. Luckily, they had one of history's staunchest and toughest leaders, Winston Churchill, who, along with President Roosevelt, was indispensable in the Allies winning the war. Margaret remembers the insatiable air raids, actually saw enemy airplanes overhead, witnessed explosions, fires, and devastation. Recalls people using London's subways as air raid shelters, had the nightmarish experience of living through their apartment being hit by an incendiary bomb, and later heard the frightening drone of German V-2 rockets over London. Thank you, Margaret, for recalling for us what life was like during those awful days in London. Friends, Margaret Garrett Irwin has published a book entitled The Journal of Anne Redding, From Florence Nightingale to Dorothea Dix and Beyond. She's been published in Dancing USA, the San Luis Obispo magazine, and is currently busy writing an autobiography. We thank Margaret for her story tonight and hope she has more contributions for us in years to come. And so we come to the end of another edition of Valley Writers Read. Thank you for listening. If you'd like to listen to tonight's or any other Valley Writers Read story again, just go online to kvpr.org and link up with archived audio. Next week, our writer reader will be Jerry Fisher. In the meantime, this is your host, Franz Weinschenk, wishing you and yours a great life story until we meet again. Good night.
Valley Writers Read is a production of Valley Public Radio, produced by Don Weaver and Franz Weinschenk. Please join us again next Wednesday at 7 p.m. for another edition of Valley Writers Read.